From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the December 2020 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Oral History 2020. At the end of every year, we like to catch up with Jonathan Byrne, our oral history officer, and he normally tells us how many dozens and dozens and dozens of interviews he's carried out this year and which ones have stood out for him. And we bring you a selection of those interviews, or if we're trying to focus on a certain topic or subject. I have Jonathan with me. We're sat at Bletchley Park in the archive now. But you, as with many other people, haven't been here most of the year, have you?
That's true. It's been a funny year. I've actually not been here since April, from April to mid-October. I was on furlough like many people at Bletchley Park. And then came back in October, been back for 3 weeks, and it all started again, where I was at least working part of the time for a month. And here we are now in December, and hopefully back to normal for a while.
Well, let's hope so. Yes, I was a bit shocked when you emailed me a few weeks ago and said, oh, I'm back. So I knew I'd be able to sit here with you. But obviously 2020 has taken a toll on the oral history. But let's start on the positive.
Yeah.
January and February this year, how did the year start?
Started pretty well. By the end of February, which was the last face-to-face interview we did, we had done 12 interviews.
And that's pretty good going, isn't it?
That's pretty good for January and February, because it's usually a fairly quiet time. It usually starts up in the spring and then gets busy. But, of course, it came to a grinding halt this spring.
So where are we now with the oral history in total?
The total now, since we started just over 9 years ago, is 550 interviews
that's
we've
fantastic.
Done, which is brilliant. And I say 12 of those this year, but nothing since the end of February. We, in fact, had to cancel quite a few for obvious reasons that had been booked. But that's the way things ended in February, yeah.
And also, there's a bit of a knock-on, I suppose, because we didn't have our veterans reunion this year, because we couldn't risk the safety of our veterans. That's where you would normally collect an awful lot of the people that you're going to interview over the next year, isn't it?
That's right, yes. We would normally speak to all the usually about 80 to 100 veterans who've been attending in recent years, and those who hadn't been interviewed, we'd ask if they'd be willing for us to come and hear from them. And usually they said yes, so we didn't have that cohort this year. And of course, all the normal contact through letters and emails just didn't happen. But I think that is exactly what they expected, so I don't think they were particularly surprised.
Of all the people during Corona, I think we can probably say that, you know, our veterans have kind of been through similar circumstances already, haven't they?
Yes, funnily enough, I do remember talking to one lady who I'd already interviewed, and two of us were going to go back and ask her some more detailed questions that to do with a forthcoming exhibition. And we obviously had to call it off. And I was talking with her on the phone, and she actually made the comment, this was been sort of early March when things were really sort of beginning to happen, and or not happen. And she said, it reminds me a little bit of the start of the war. And I thought, well, that's quite a good analogy, that. You know, I know it's very different in many ways, but the uncertainty, the need for us all to behave differently in a sort of a, like a national effort almost.
National emergency, yeah. That makes sense. Our veterans probably learn a bit from them, couldn't we, about all this?
Yeah. Well, yes, I mean, I was quite interested. I remember from some of them that they've spoken about during the war, not just the work, the things we always ask them about, but all the little side details, like strange things they had to deal with, uncertain times, the changes it brought to their life and their families. I've managed to find a few examples which will illustrate that and maybe provide some, maybe not inspiration as such, but certainly some comparison of what we're going through now.
I think you're right, Jonathan. I think it is inspiration and comparison. I'm lucky enough to become very good friends with one of our veterans, Betty Webb, over the years. And I actually speak to Betty every week on the phone, and not just during the pandemic. I have for years now, because she always makes me laugh. And I like to make her giggle by saying something silly to her. But I found speaking to Betty all the way through this year, she's like a kind of rock, because she's just been steady right through this. And I think that it speaks to their stoicism, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. In some ways, they've been through it all before.
And yeah, you know, just because someone's old, it doesn't mean they don't know about the modern world, because they do, because, you know, history repeats itself.
Yeah.
So you've selected out four interviews for this episode. Do you want to explain about the first one for
us? The first one is a lady who I interviewed about 4 years ago called Gwen Adsley. She was Gwen Hook during the war. And she worked at Bletchley Park. She was a civilian working in the communication section, dealing with the communications that were coming in and out of Bletchley Park, making sure that they were kept secure. Now, she, as well as telling us about her work, which is in itself great interest, there were a couple of things she talked about which were sort of reminded you of the wartime conditions. First of all, she talks a bit about food, the fact she was hungry a lot of the time, but there was a particular occasion when she and one of her friends quite unexpectedly had a little bonus. That was one of the lucky things that happened to her, but her family home in South London was hit by the enemy during an air raid, and her parents were injured, although survived and recovered eventually. And she found herself having to deal with her parents' welfare while still carrying on doing her job at Bletchley Park.
Oh, still working here?
Still working here. I think from what she was saying, that because she was very, very young, as you know, something we always have to keep reminding, these folks were very, very young at the time, she perhaps didn't really occur to her that she could have asked for a bit of help.
Yeah.
So she was doing all sorts of things to help herself to sort out her parents. But it did make a bit of a strain on her, as we'll hear.
When the war began, I was at school. And most of my school was evacuated. Well, I was quite grown up my years. My mother said, "You're not going off with a lot of children. You best to get a job." Anyway, I waited at home for a little while and then I thought, yes, I'm bored. So I went to London to a bureau and I got a job in the city in the offices of a tailoring establishment, which I did happily for over a year. And then I transferred to the local gas company where I did copy typing, typing out accounts, which was a bit boring. But of course, when I became 18, all the girls were doing different things. Some wanted to go in the Wrens, some wanted the Air Force or the Land Army. I was quite happy to wait and see what befell me. I registered and waited a while, well, quite a while, several weeks, until a letter came saying, "Would you please report for an interview in London at the Foreign Office on a certain date?" So I thought, oh, this is going to be the job. So off I went and was interviewed by a very nice lady. And she asked me lots of questions and things I'd already filled in on the form, which was I passed the Royal Society of Arts in mathematics, English, typing, handwriting, which I was very proud of my writing. And then all sorts of things. What did I do for a hobby? I've always read a lot of books. I did like crosswords and several other things. So she said, "You will hear from us." Well, I waited another few days and then a letter came asking me to catch a certain train to Bletchley where I would be met and taken to a billet ready for a job in Buckinghamshire.
So at this stage, they hadn't mentioned anything about code breaking or Bletchley Park?
Nothing at all.
So when you got to Bletchley Station, they took you to your billet first?
Yes, I was met at the station by a lady with a car, and she took me out to Wolverton, to this nice little house. Anyway, we entered, and she said, "Now, your landlady is profoundly deaf, but she can lip read." So I was introduced to her, and it was a bit difficult to make communication, but we managed. It was a very comfortable, clean little house. And the other girl was going to be with me, arrived later in the day. Her name was Fiona Isles. She originally was from Oban in Scotland, but she'd been living in Portsmouth where her father was a naval officer. Anyway, we became really good friends. We each had a double bedroom to ourselves, but of course no bathroom, which was not very good, especially on the cold winter mornings when you had this jug and basin with icy water and you've got to be ready for the coach. It was no good delaying anything.
So did they take you into Bletchley the next day?
The next morning. The next morning we had to get the coach. So we went into the park, went into the mansion. We were seated. I would think there were probably 20 of us. And a gentleman, I believe to be Josh Cooper, came in and gave us a little chat and said it was important work we were doing. And above all things, never talk about it. That was the most important thing, secrecy. Not even outside your hut, not even when you go to the canteen. And above all, not even after the war. Well, I kept that absolutely strict. But of course, after the war, I was a bit upset when it did all come out because I thought I'd made my vow not to talk about it.
So do you remember that when it came out? It was about 1974?
70s.
Yeah. You were quite shocked, were you, at the time? Mm. No, a lot of people say just the same, yeah. Mm. When did you feel yourself that you could talk about it?
Because obviously, not for years. No, I felt it was wrong. And then I only just said, yes, I was there. I never said much else. I really thought it was a big mistake. But I do appreciate now that needs probably, I don't know, is it needs to let the younger people know and tell the world. I don't know.
Well, I'm glad you are allowed to talk about it now, obviously, because it's what we do now.
This is it, yes, yes.
Your landlady provided some of your meals.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Was she a good cook? Well, I know it was wartime.
Well, yes, of course. I appreciate it was rationing, and as the war went on, it got worse. Yeah. But no, it wasn't good. Breakfast was always prunes. Ooh. I've never looked at a prune since.
Don't blame you.
With the cereal.
Yeah, possibly.
And then, she did a reasonable little dinner, but she was a very small lady herself. I hope none of her descendants read this. Very small lady. And the only thing she realised how much we could really eat. I never saw her eat anything or drink a cup of tea even. And she was frail little person. Yes. Take, for example, if we were on night duty, we slept in the day, we got up and we had a dinner at 6 o'clock. We went off to the park at 10:15. We'd had nothing else then, went off to the park 10:15. We had something called a supper about 1 o'clock in the morning, which was very meagre, and something called a breakfast about 7 in the park, which I must tell you was cereal and one slice of toast. Mm. And once I thought, when she's not looking, I'll go up and get another slice. And a hand came out and slapped my hand and shrieked out, one slice only. So that was actually what we had. And we went back home and got home at 10:15. And she made us a cup of tea, and that was just a cup of tea.
Yeah.
And then nothing again, we went to bed until the 6 o'clock dinner. So it was sort of small meals spread out. When I tell you that one day we were ravenous, we were walking about round Wolverton, we found a little baker's shop. Fiona said, I wonder if they've got any cakes or anything. I thought, go and ask. The woman said, well, I've sold my rota because it was all ration for today, but she said, I can let you have a small loaf. So, yes, we'll have a small loaf. Well, we came out, and of course it wasn't done in those days to eat walking alone.
No.
It definitely wasn't the thing. We tore it in half. I said, we go the back way, all through these back alleyways, pulling off bits, pulling off anything. Now, that's how hungry we were. We would have eaten anything.
Yeah.
At 18, 19, I was very, very, very thin. Tall, very tall.
Yes.
But okay, didn't upset me. I was always happy.
Mm.
I enjoyed my time there. Mm. I really did. I enjoyed the company, the girls. Yeah. I really did.
Yeah. Mm. During your shift, did they ever bring tea round or could you make tea or coffee?
No. That's why we desperately tried this awful water.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, nothing like that. All we had there was across to the canteen when it was our time.
Mm.
I think we only had about half an hour. I do remember in the summer when it was a nice day shift, just sitting on the grass for a little while by the lake before we had to get back quickly.
Yeah. Mm. Were all the friends you made people you worked with? Or you didn't meet
some? Only the people in my heart.
Yeah.
That was Fiona, who was with me in the billet, Edna, who I've known now for... Well, till she died, and she'd been here, and I've been to her house, and she had her family, and I had my family. Betty Cutler, and the other girls in there, I didn't know that well.
Did you get much in the way of leave so you could actually go home?
If I remember rightly, it was a one day every 3 weeks.
Mm.
Now, that doesn't sound much, does it?
Was that when the shift sort of changed?
Well, yes.
In the middle.
Yeah. And always, I was after the long changeover, which we called it, which I'd come off night work, say, Saturday morning, and Sunday I'd have my day off, and Monday I'd come back for 4 o'clock.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. So that way I seemed to get quite a bit at home.
Yeah, and you came back to London.
I came back home, South London. Yeah. But some of the others didn't go home, rarely.
Yeah.
One girl came from Wales, and of course Fiona hardly ever went home.
So they never gave you a week off or anything like that?
No. Definitely not a week off. We collected our wages from that little post office by the side of the mansion.
Yeah.
And I can't honestly remember how much, but I've got a recollection of 35 shillings.
I think from what other people told me, that sounds about right.
Does it all good?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. But that was, had they taken the money out for your billet by the time? Yeah. Yes.
The 2 guineas. Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know what they took for the food at the park. Mm.
So you never had to hand cash over when you went?
No. We just were paid. Somebody say, oh, it's payday. Oh, yes. Of course, everyone smoked.
Yeah.
Everyone. Mm. The rooms were blue with smoke. Yes. And the mansion always smelt of coffee brewing. If you went inside the mansion, lovely smell of fresh coffee roasted and brewing.
Were you able to go and have that coffee?
No.
You see, this is so funny because some people tell me that they used to go and have coffee. Mm-hmm. You know, they were doing same sort of jobs as you. And others, like myself, we never went there.
So well, Edna was rather go ahead and she just said to me, come on, we'll go in there, we can get... And I said, no.
Because you did say that when your family were bombed, of course.
Oh, yes.
You obviously were able to take some time off. So was there a welfare sort of officer or something?
No.
How did that...
Well, the message came through in the night... And I just went. I ran all the way through that little path. No, I didn't ask anyone's opinion. I just went. Mm. Somehow I was granted leave. Yeah. I don't know how that happened. Mm. I was away 3 weeks. Was it then? Because I was away another time. Whatever. I had to deal with so much. I really grew up. I really did. It was a nightmare.
I'm sure, yeah.
And I hadn't much money. And I was, you know, transport. Anyway, I came back again once they were out of hospital and settled with a friend. I came back again. Luckily, we had friends at Bushy. Policemen had served time with my father. And they said, come and stay here. And they recuperated there. And I was able to shoot down whenever I got a few hours to Bushy because it was easier, quicker. I'd come to Watford on the train and come and see and do what I could and work out where they would live. And then when I got a bit longer, I'd go down to London and try and sort out the remains of the furniture and the belongings and everything, and then find another place and install it in it and clean it. You imagine moving without any pre-packing and with the places full of broken glass and brick dust, and the actual civil defence men were the only ones allowed in there because it was dangerous.
God.
And they just picked up any available thing and shot things in, you know, photographs and they were all bottles, everything was and taken out and moved. And I had to sort that out.
Gosh, yeah.
Anyway, I came back again to work and I worked through that summer, but hopping about in between up and down. And by about October, I began to feel really ill.
This is 1944 we're talking.
This is 1944.
Yes, sorry.
I began to really feel... You know, I couldn't get myself together to go and do the work. So Fiona said to me, look, there's something wrong. You can't go on like this. She said, I'm taking you to the doctor. So we went round. We had, of course, registered a doctor in Wolverton. I went round and he said, you're suffering from nervous debility. Go home and have a rest with your parents and take it easy. So I looked at him. I said, I haven't got a home to go to. Anyway, I thought, I've got my married elder sister living in Kent. I thought, if I'm going to go home for a bit of a rest, I'll go there. So I packed my bag and went off again. Doctor gave me a medical certificate. I left it on the table. Missus wasn't about, and I'd no shouting it all out at her or trying to get her to understand it. Left it on the table so she could see, for Fiona to take back into work to explain. And I stayed down there for a little while. I think that was when I had 3 weeks off. And then I had to come back. And the doctor said to me, I should get you a release on compassionate grounds. Mm. You're needed to look after your family, which I did. So that's how I ended up there.
Yeah. It sounds like you didn't get much support from your sort of management at Bletchley Park.
No.
You had to do all yourself.
No, not at all.
Gosh. Yeah.
I didn't expect it.
No. I mean, obviously they were busy working. You know, every day, but I would have thought there was like a welfare organisation, you know.
Nothing.
Gosh, that's...
No, I didn't feel hard done by.
No.
Because I think in those days you just got on with things.
Of course, yeah.
You know.
And I suppose you weren't the first person that had happened to, you know, something like that.
I just put in the necessary doctor's certificates, and even when I left, you know, I went and collected all my things and said goodbye, walked to the station and... Yeah.
Don't suppose they had leaving parties.
We didn't expect a lot.
No.
It's a different world.
Yes. I think that's a good point because I'm thinking of how I'd expect it to be done now. And of course, it was different then.
Oh, no, there'd be a hue and cry.
Yeah.
No. We did as we were told.
Yes.
Always. Yeah. Really, yes. That's why my mother never knew about my dancing activities, because she would be out in the night with strange airmen. So, I mean, I was the third one of three girls, and I grew up more or less to be on their level. That they had hard work to get opportunities. Could we stay out till 10 o'clock? But by the time I came along, okay, it was acceptable. So yeah. I'd benefited from that, from being the third one. Yeah. And so I was quite worldly wise. Mm. I wasn't silly. Mm.
No.
You know.
When you went home, I mean, before, you know, when you just went home in normal times, did your family ever ask what you were doing? Were they at all?
No. My parents, obviously, once they've been injured, were too taken up with their own problems.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
But I do remember my oldest sister, the one I stayed with in Kent, she said, "What are you doing up there in Buckinghamshire?" to me. And I said, "Boring old office work." That was my answer. Boring old office work. So nobody else really did inquire. Yeah. But when it all came out, my brothers-in-law, they said, "You never told us anything." You know, they said, well, and because my parents died before 1966, they never knew. My dad would have been proud because he'd been in the army, you know.
A lot of people tell me the same, that, you know, their parents never knew what they did.
It was absolutely impressed upon us. No, I wish I could remember more the exact amount of woods, because when I went back, I was quite stunned. I know it was all car park nearly, wasn't it? And I thought, well, no. But I did like the atmosphere and the green and the trees, the lovely big trees. I thought it was a lovely place. I must tell you how pleased I was when I read the message the Queen, the speech she gave when she came to Vale Memorial. And she spoke about all the good work and everything. And the bit at the end was lovely. And she said, "We mustn't forget the girls, the women who left their homes and came under difficult circumstances to work." At the women, she said, "On behalf of a grateful nation, I thank them." And I thought that was lovely. Because so often now, it's these great men, or this handful of women, I don't know, 10, wonderful work. Yes, they did wonderful work. But after that, never mind about what the rest of us were doing. And I think it was lovely.
Yeah. That's something we're very keen to teach people, that it wasn't just those great men.
They couldn't have accomplished what they did without. So I really liked that bit. I thought it was lovely.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. We're now going to move away from Bletchley Park and remember that, of course, it didn't all happen here.
No.
Without the work of the Y Service doing the interception of the enemy messages, there would have been nothing for Bletchley Park to work on. About 3 years ago, I interviewed Trixie Davison, and she'd been a member of the Auxiliary Territorial Service, the women's branch of the army, and was a wireless operator intercepting enemy messages at Kedleston Hall and Forest Moor, two separate Y stations.
Where was Kedleston Hall?
Kedleston Hall is in Derbyshire. And yes, and you can visit it now as it's run by the National Trust. She described how she was working as a civil servant when war broke out in a building which I think we worked out between us is now the location of the National Archives in Kew, although it was another government department at the time. And she wanted to do a bit, so she volunteered and joined the ATS. And like most people who worked for Bletchley Park, or many people certainly, she had no previous knowledge of the sort of work she was involved in, but found herself being trained to operate radios and to read Morse, and then was sent to work at, as I said, Kedleston Hall and Forest Moor. So her story is quite interesting in the training. There's some quite good detail on the setup, you know, how these places were organised and the way they worked.
And I bet she still knew her Morse, didn't she?
I think she probably did. Most of them do, actually. Yeah. Yes, yeah, that's right.
I think it's one of the boxes ticked when you interview a wide service operator.
Yeah. Yeah.
At some point, they will speak Morse back to you.
They do, yes. And I remember, another lady said that when she used to wait for a bus and she got bored, she'd start doing the timetable in Morse in her head. It's great.
At some stage, then, you must have been called up for national service.
I wasn't called up. I volunteered.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I volunteered.
Right.
No, as a civil servant, I need not have gone into the forces.
Yes.
No, I decided to volunteer.
Right.
The beginning of 1942.
Right. And so you decided you wanted to join, was it the
ATS? Yes. Yeah. And of course, we'd already suffered the Blitz over London. And I suppose I sort of had, you know, radar in my mind that's what I really wanted to do. I opted to be a radar operator. And having enlisted and gone to Honiton, which is the sort of reception depot, they've got various ones all around, the introduction to army life there. And from there, I went to the radar training school at Devizes. But I hadn't been there more than a week or two, you know, sitting in a dark room, obviously, only training, obviously, but peering at the screen. They realised that my eyesight wasn't good enough for radar. So I had to go back to Honiton again to remuster. And they offered me, well, what about a wireless operator? Well, I said yes to that one because they'd already offered me cook and orderly and that kind of thing. Mm. And of course, that was almost, I didn't have to go very far because that was at Trowbridge.
Yes. Yeah. But you didn't have any background in Morse code?
I had no background whatsoever in Morse code, no. I pride myself on assimilating fresh knowledge reasonably well. And I passed out as a grade one operator from there.
Wow.
And then from there, I was bussed to Kedleston.
Mm. Now, did they tell you when you were training what the job was all about?
No, no. My recollection is that they didn't tell me what I was doing, but I can't remember whether I did it at the training school or when I got to Kedleston, signed the Official Secrets Act, but still didn't really know what it was all about until, well, I suppose the war developed and we heard news from other places, and I suppose we collectively we came to realise that that's probably what we were doing.
Yeah.
But no, we were never actually told in words of one syllable that we were intercepting German messages.
But I suppose you were able to sort of work it out for yourself and keep
exactly
it quiet.
Yes, yes.
Yes. So Kedleston, now that is Derbyshire, is that right?
Kedleston Hall, Derbyshire, yes. It was the ancestral home of Lord Curzon.
Now that must be quite a magnificent house. It's National Trust, I think, now, isn't it?
Oh, it is a National Trust, yeah.
What was Kedleston Hall like when you got there? Were you in the house or were you in huts or what?
We were the first squad that went there and they were still building the huts. And the first night we were there, we were escorted into the kitchens of Kedleston Hall and issued with two straw palliasses, all right, on the stone floor and sleep the night there.
Yeah.
But luckily, it was only for one night because it was only just the finishing touches to the huts.
Yes,
and then the huts were sort of on a little bit of rising ground above the house. Mm. In a very nice position. I mean, it was gorgeous countryside there, really lovely.
Lovely, yeah.
And I'm a country kind of person, but I really appreciated it there. And that we were in huts, 12 of us in a hut, in two-tier bunks, and there were three huts comprising one watch on duty.
Yes.
And we were in watch, I was in watch A.
Yes.
Hut A3, Hut A3 it would have been, yes.
So if you were everyone on the same watch was in the same hut?
The whole of A watch, all went,
yes.
We lined up, we marched to what they call the ops block, and that was a brick-built building.
And was that newly built as well?
Oh, it was new, yes.
Yeah.
All the construction for the wireless ops was all newly built for them, yes.
Yeah.
We had a naffy there as well, of course, but that was a bit small and pokey and didn't see very much of me anyway. Any off-duty time, if it was nice, whether it was daytime or whether it was into the evening and getting dark, we'd take a walk down, because there were two drives to Kedleston Hall, the south one and the north one, and there was a lovely walk right down the drive, which was about a mile long, cross a bridge over the lake in the park, walk down there and back again. And I mean, and it wasn't, there was no traffic on that because all the traffic that came to Kedleston Hall all used the north gate, not the south gate. So, I mean, it was just like a country walk down there, there and back again, much better than spending the evening in a smoke-filled naffy anyway.
Yes, of course,
Not my line at all.
No. And was it virtually all girls working there where you were?
We were all girls.
So tell me about the work. You went to the ops block. So what happened once you went in there?
Well, we went in there and there were two radio sets side by side on that side of the room and two more that side of the room. And altogether, I mean, it would have been that number of operators. We sat down, put our headphones on, picked up the pencil, looked at the pad and waited for something to happen.
Yes.
Or, of course, sometimes if we were relieving the previous operator, there was facility then for us, and if she was busy taking some kind of traffic, there was facility on the set for us to plug in headphones at the sides and not put them completely on, but put them to one ear so that we could gradually let her go home and us take over and not lose anything that was being transmitted.
So you would pick up the same message that someone else was doing before you?
Yes, because, I mean, the sets in the ops block were in the main tuned to different radio frequencies. Sometimes two were on the one on the same frequency, but I mean, I don't know how many wireless stations the enemy had, but obviously we were endeavouring to cover everything rather than double up on anything.
Yes, of course.
But it was sometimes necessary to double up. If you were on a frequency that appeared to be very, very busy, and also if interference was very bad, it was sometimes advisable to have two operators picking up the same messages so that perhaps one would hear, the other wouldn't.
So did you actually have a radio set in front of you at your station?
In front of us, yes.
And presumably you had to sort of tune it occasionally.
Oh, yes, there were all kinds of dials that were all over it, yes. Mm. Oh, yes, because, well, I suppose like our radios at home, perhaps not so much now because they're more perfected, but I mean, several decades ago, I mean, radio stations in this country, the ordinary domestic radio could slip off its frequency, couldn't it?
Oh, yes.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes, you had to, you know, sort of perhaps follow it a little bit. If it appeared to be going, you had to sort of go with it, you might say.
Mm. Can you remember what the radio sets were called? Did they have a name or a number that you knew?
They were either RTO or RKO. I can't remember which. They were huge, great things. They were desk in front of me, they were quite that high.
A couple of feet high.
Oh, yes, you had a real room. That was in front of you, you might say.
Gosh,
you couldn't see down the room anyway. Yeah. All you could see was what was in front of you like that,
Did you have some sort of message pad to write them on?
Yes, oh, yes, message pads, yes. Yeah. They were, of course, white, and I think the outlining and any lettering on the pads was in red. But, of course, we were working, well, if it was a night shift or winter time and dark, gloomy in the daytime, the room was lighted, obviously, so we weren't groping around in the dark.
No. When a message finished, did somebody come and did you put your hand up, or how did you sort of pass it on to wherever it needed to go?
Oh, we tear the top sheet off and hold it up like that. Because there was somebody more or less permanently walking up and down the room collecting the sheets, so that as an operator you always had a blank sheet in front of you until you started writing something on it, When the sheet was full, you'd take it off like that.
Where did it go then?
Well, it went into another room where there were some members of the intelligence corps were sitting. What they did with it up there, I don't quite know. I always imagine that they probably had teleprinters up there, but I'm not all that sure. But every so often, during a shift, you'd hear a dispatch rider drive away. Mm. Or whether he was driving away with our pieces of paper or something that the intelligence corps had given him. I mean, one of those things you never found out while you were there.
From what I've heard from other people, I think they did have teleprinters to send them on, yes. So,
Yes, I think there was teleprinters in those days, wasn't it? Yes, I think so, yes.
But did they tell you anything about where it went after Kedleston? Were you given any indication?
No, all the time I was in the forces, I never heard the word Bletchley Park mentioned, never once. Yeah. I always imagined that possibly it went for some reason or other. I mean, there was another station at Loughborough, and there was another station at, was it at Shenley, just outside?
Shenley, near Watford, sort of St Albans area.
Well, because somebody that I made friends with at Kedleston, she got a transfer to Shenley because her fiancé worked at Fairey Aviation at Hayes and wasn't going in the forces and they were planning to get married fairly soon. So she managed to wangle a transfer to Shenley so that she could, you know, get home and see her fiancé in between times. Mm. And I never went anywhere near the one that was it called Loughborough?
The one near Loughborough was called Bow Manor.
Oh, Bow Manor, yeah. That's right. Yes,
that was a big house as well. I don't think it's quite as grand as Kenneth.
Never went near there.
Did you ever hear of a place known as Station X? Did you ever hear that phrase?
I did hear about Station X, but I can't really remember when I heard about Station X. Yeah. I know Station X is Bletchley, isn't it?
Yeah. No, it's just that one or two ladies I've spoken to who were at places like Bow Manor, like you, they'd never heard of Bletchley Park, but they knew that what they took down went to somewhere called Station X.
Oh, really?
But they didn't know where Station X was, you know.
Oh, I see. I can't remember, but I mean, my memory is still reasonably good, but to think back to the 1940s when we're in 2010 onwards.
That's quite all right.
It's asking a lot of my memory, isn't it? I don't think I heard about Station X.
No, that's fine.
But I knew they went somewhere, and I thought that this is where these dispatch riders were taking away whatever it was. But as I say, the whole thing was so much shrouded in secrecy that you were really almost like spending your life inside a tent and not knowing what's going on outside.
Yeah. And so it was 1942 you started at Kedleston Hall.
Yes.
And you said you were one of the first there. Did you stay at Kedleston Hall throughout the war, or did you go anywhere else to do the same job?
From Kedleston, I went up to Forest Moor outside Harrogate. Yes, but it wasn't the whole watch that went. No. I don't know how they worked it out, but I mean, they sort of picked, well, you and you kind of thing.
Oh, I see, yeah.
Yes.
And when was that, roughly?
That was early in 44, I should think.
Okay, right.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Except that when we got up to Forest Moor, I mean, we found that it was a brand new station. Obviously they wanted it manned.
I would expect they wanted, if they were setting up a new place at Forest Moor, they wanted at least some people who knew what they were doing. You know,
that's what I mean.
So the work was exactly the same.
The work was exactly the same, yes, yes. The ox block, when you got inside, it looked exactly the same as well.
If we can just finish off with your wartime story.
Oh, yes.
When did you finish at Forest Moor?
Well, I finished at Forest Moor when Jenny and I got the opportunity to volunteer for wireless operator service in India at Bangalore.
Yes.
We both thought that would be a wonderful idea. And I think we both sounded our parents wrong, our mothers, actually. And so we then had to go back to Kedleston because that was where they were doing the training in Japanese Morse. They weren't doing it at Harrogate, so we had to leave Harrogate, go back to Kedleston, and had the various inoculations and things. And I think our embarkation date was almost settled when the atomic bomb was dropped at Hiroshima. Mm. So the whole thing just stopped like that. Yeah. And the wireless work in this country was also slowing down because, of course, the war in Europe was then over. So it was a question of, what are we going to do now? Or wait for remustering? Our time was really just killed our time there, you might say. Mm. I started learning German there, but didn't get very far. Well, not. I suppose I assimilated a bit of German, but we weren't hanging around there long enough to really acquire any good knowledge. I mean, I started learning to drive an army truck, but didn't get much more than the steering wheel and the brakes. And then I was sent to Scottish Command in Edinburgh, and Jenny went to the PAYCOR in Leeds. Mm. But we still kept in communication. We used to, not every weekend, but quite often, we'd meet up in Newcastle. And stay in the hostel in Newcastle for the weekend and then go back. Yes, so as I say, my friendship with Jenny never, although we were split at that stage, it never had a break, really, no. That would be the Christmas of Hogmanay, 45. And then it was in the summer of 46 that I was demobbed, yes.
For the third clip we've got, Jonathan, we're coming back to Bletchley, but not Bletchley Park.
No, that's right. A few years ago, Milton Keynes Council very generously funded a short project on collecting memories of people who were growing up in the Bletchley Park area during the war and their memories of this place and particularly the people who worked here. In many cases, they would have been billeted on their families. So I was very pleased, well, a couple of years ago now, to interview Roy Maycock, who lives very near here. His memories went right back to the very first day of the war. I forget how old Roy was at the time, but he was a child, young child. He remembers the evacuees arriving from London. And we'll hear him talking about this strange phenomenon, all these young children turning up to escape the expected bombing in London. Many of these evacuees returned home a few months later. And shortly after that, their places in the local families were taken by the staff of Bletchley Park.
Of course, because, you know, that's where all the billeting was, wasn't it?
Exactly, yeah.
To start with, in the home. So, yeah, I've never thought about that.
No, I mean, I think to start with, Bletchley was probably like anywhere else outside of London that you will take evacuees. Yeah. Because the bombing didn't start straight away, a lot of families drifted back home to the big cities. And then, of course, Bletchley Park was beginning to expand. So the government was then needing these places in people's homes to house Bletchley Park staff. His family, having had these children billeted on them first, a bit later, they were having Bletchley Park staff.
I'm delighted to be interviewing Mr. Roy Maycock here in Bletchley, who's going to tell us about his memories of the wartime Bletchley area. So can I ask, first of all, when you were born?
I was born in May 1933, so I was just about six. Yeah, that's right. I lived in this house, was born in this house, so I've been here all my life. I had a mother and a father and no brothers, no sisters. And I went to school in Bletchley at the primary school, the infant school and junior school. Then I went to the Cedar School at Leighton Buzzard. While the war was on, we were there for VE Day. VJ Day, of course, was in school holidays.
What did your family do?
I was going to say my mother didn't do anything.
I'm sure not.
Well, from the early days, she had a mother for a long time who was ill. And so she had to spend most of her daytime looking after her mother. She had to come home to get my father his midday meal. And I was bundled off to school. I had dinners at school from quite a young age, from the junior school. So I was out of the house and everybody else, or the others, were out of the house. And then after her mother died, then that's when we started to have evacuees and a variety of people that came to stay during the war. So the house was never empty of people other than the three of us.
What did your father do?
Now, this is where the bakehouse comes in. Oh. He was the manager at the bakehouse.
Right, at the co-op?
Yeah, and I used to spend hours in the bakehouse where I shouldn't have been. But And you know, if I was out longer than my mum expected, she used to say, well, you've been to the bakehouse, haven't you? So I said, well, how did you know? She said, well, I got flour over me.
But what do you remember about the war breaking out in 39?
I couldn't remember it as if it was yesterday. It was either the 1st, the 2nd or the 3rd. It was the Sunday.
Yeah, it was the 3rd of September, which I think was a Sunday, when Britain declared war on Germany.
And yes, I can remember, because it was a lovely day. And where Sainsbury's and the car park now is, that was the field. That was the holding field for cattle and sheep that were sold at the market. Bletchley Road or Queensway used to go directly through. And the cattle market was virtually on the edge of that road. There were a few odds and ends, a few shops.
Yeah.
But that's where the cattle market was.
Yeah.
And these evacuees, great long queue of them, in that field.
Yeah.
And my bedroom was upstairs.
Yes.
And I was watching all these.
You were overlooking it.
Yeah. And they'd all got a bag and a tag attached to them, or a gas mask. And then, as kids were disciplined in those days, they walked in a long queue, two at a time. And they must have, the various people must have taken a sort of stream of children away with them, and I can remember them coming along this street and sort of saying, well, you go in there and you go in there, and so on. And we had two girls with us. I have no idea how many kids there were, but...
And where did they come from?
They all came from the school in Islington, but I couldn't even remember their names.
No.
Mary Guthridge was one.
And how long did those two girls stay with
them? Well, they didn't stay very long. as far as I can remember. And I obviously don't remember myself, but I was told several times that when my parents went to bed, the two girls had to be in the same bedroom when supposedly in the same bed. But they found that only one of the girls was in the bed. The other one they found under the bed. And she was asked why she was there. And she said, well, that's where I had to sleep when I was at home. And then she was still in the clothes that she'd been wearing. And they said, well, why hadn't you taken your clothes off? And she couldn't because they were stitched to her.
Gosh.
Yeah. So it must have been a very poor... And she'd got a brother evacuated, as far as I know, the same time. And somehow they got together. And I think they both went quite early.
Yes.
Back to London, were taken back to London. And the other girl, she stayed with us a bit longer, but I think she went back to London.
Did you then have other children with you?
No, we didn't have any more children, but we had a variety of people. And the first one I remember was a Sergeant Waff. And she was with us for 2 or 3 years at least, and then was taken again, as far as I know, into the park.
Yeah, what they did, both the Army and the Air Force separately, they built camps just the other side of Bletchley Park.
Yes.
Church Green was the RAF one. So all these WAFs and airmen who had the relative comfort of living with families suddenly found themselves living in a camp with barracks and inspections and being shouted at.
I don't think she was very pleased at having to go.
No, they weren't.
And she was fluent in German, and she tried to teach me a bit of German. Wow.
Do you remember her name?
Yeah, I do, yes.
What's that?
Eleanor MacDowell. And that little blue book there.
Oh, yeah.
She gave me that.
The Jungle Book.
When she left here.
Oh, how nice.
And that edition was published in 1942. So she must have left us later than 1942. I suspect it was 1943, probably, that she actually left. And then soon after she'd gone, then we had a civilian person there who was Denise Parkhouse. But she was only with us for about a day or two. And when I came home from school, she was just going up the road and round the corner to get to Luton because she'd got measles.
Oh, no.
So she then came back to us and stayed for a long time. Look at the book underneath.
Yes.
Look at the Christmas card, and that's the one I had from her this year.
So she's still alive, obviously. Yeah.
So she must be about 93, aren't
I? You don't have any idea what Eleanor's MacDowell's sort of what her job was?
No, I have no idea.
Because a lot of the WAFs working at Bletchley Park were working in the communications centre, so they're operating teleprinters, or you can send Morse over a paper tape system, which is a bit like a teleprinter.
Yes, yeah.
So they might well be doing that. Some were working in the code breaking areas as well, but most were doing the communications.
I've always imagined that she had something to do because she was so fluent in German.
Oh, more likely to be code-breaking then, yes.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah. And she was a sergeant.
Oh, well,
So I assumed put three stripes and language together and thought she must be a bit more...
That's right, yeah. Now, do you remember much about the effect of the war... Not the Bletchley Park, but things like air raids and, you know, that sort of stuff.
I don't think we had any, or very few. I can remember being told one night to come downstairs, and I haven't a clue now why. I think as a child, like I do now, I sleep well. So whether there had been an air raid in the night sometime, I have no idea. And the only thing, again, I wasn't aware of it, but of course when they bombed Coventry, they said why we saw them here was because it was a moonlit night and they followed the canal. Certainly a lot of people have said about using the canal as a line to follow. I mean, lights you could blot out in a way, couldn't you? But you couldn't block out the canal.
No, that's right. I know it's difficult, but I'm asking you to start talking about a period when you were only six, but thank you very much for that.
Well, I mean, I know more the effect that it had on the house rather than what, you know, I can remember, you know, we started off more or less with the evacuees coming. I can remember that ever so clearly. And the people that we had, all the evacuees that I can remember around here were girls.
Huh.
There must have been boys somewhere because the girl directly opposite who, like me, has lived in that house all her life. She's between 3 and 4 years younger than I am. And they had two girls, and the people next door, they just had one girl. And those three stayed, I think they must have stayed all through the war, because they never had anybody. Well, apparently they did, these people that I didn't even remember, but Barbara did say, somebody that worked at Bletchley Park there. I don't remember any of the rest of the street had evacuees or anything. And if they did, just this little bevy of girls.
So let's have a last selection for this episode then, Jonathan. Yeah. Who have you got for us?
Well, I've got Molly Morgan, who was Molly Darby during the war. She was a Wren, a member of the Women's Royal Naval Service at Bletchley Park in the naval section. And her story is going to be very useful for when we develop one of our new exhibitions coming up. But again, I was looking at this from sort of not so much for the work she did, which we're very interested in and, you know, will be using to the full, but this sort of change of life, the sort of things people had to go through that were sort of thrust on them by war. And she had a very good job. And in fact, it was reserved occupation. She didn't have to join the armed forces, but she wanted to.
So there were certain jobs during the war that they were called reserved occupations. Why was that?
That's because, important as joining the armed forces were, there were certain jobs that people were already doing that were so important to the running of the country that people were exempt from conscription. So train drivers, for example, trains still had to run. And funnily enough, some of the staff at Bletchley Park were in reserved occupations. Those who worked on, say, the data processing equipment, the Hollerith machines.
Oh, really?
They were already working for the company British Tabulating Machines.
Reserved occupations already?
Yeah, that's right. So some people came to Bletchley Park who would have otherwise been called up but remained in their civilian jobs to work at Bletchley Park, but working alongside people who'd been called up from other jobs and been put into uniform or doing national service as civilians. And I think some of the people in reserved occupations actually really felt, important as their work was, they really wanted to do more. They wanted to be directly involved in the war effort.
We hear that so often, don't we?
Indeed, and Molly was certainly one of these people, as we'll hear.
I was a secretary in the Bank of England. I hated every minute of it because I didn't want to live in London. I wanted to live in the country. And anyway, I was put there. I was very highly trained. And it was, of course, becoming a reserved occupation. So after I'd been in about 4 months, I heard on the grapevine that it was becoming a reserved occupation. And I went in my lunch hour to Admiralty and I joined up in the Wrens because I'm of a naval family and they were only taking people of a naval family in those days. So I joined up and went back and resigned to the Bank of England. Otherwise, I'd have to be there for the whole year, which wasn't my idea at all. So I went home, I told my mother and father. My mother's one remark was, well, wait until after dinner, dear, before you tell your father. So I told my father, and I was out on my ear that night, out of the house. I hadn't seen him for another 2.5 years. They were strict in those days. Yes.
So was that the fact that you'd gone against sort of his intentions rather than it was the...
Yes. Yeah. He said I was so plug ugly that I probably wouldn't get married and that I'd have to have a job with a pension. And as he knew directors in the Bank of England, I was got in with the high speeds and things I had.
When was this approximately? What was the rough date of this?
That must be 1940, 41.
Right, okay.
41, yes, because I landed up in Bletchley. Well, I'll go back a bit.
Yeah.
So I couldn't join up for 6 weeks because it was a time lag. And so I got a job in London in a flat. And then when I was called up, I was trained in the Wrens in a college in North London. And the head of that was my uncle, who was an admiral, and he had me in on the mat and said, don't you dare mention you're my niece. I didn't know, couldn't dream of it. And I stayed there for a month. And then I was suddenly told I was going elsewhere. I was going to somewhere called Pembroke Fife. I hadn't a clue where that was. And I told my mother, who was on the phone to her, and I said, I don't know where I'm going, but I'm told that it's something a little bit hush-hush. So she said, well, you must know where you're going. I said, I don't. I've been told to go to Euston Station, which I did. I was given a ticket to Bletchley, so that I didn't know until then. And I was met at Bletchley and put to Woburn to check for a towel for 2 days. The old woman serving cold soup in that very, very cold winter. Mm. And her nose dripping into the soup. I'll never forget that. Dreadful. And from there, I went to Bletchley, out to the park. And I was told I was going to be the second secretary to Frank Birch. And Frank Birch, as you probably know, was Widow Twankey in pantomimes and, you know, Superman. Anyway, I didn't meet him for a couple of days. And his chief secretary was a woman called Elizabeth McWilliam, who was terrifying. And when I did meet Frank, I was told to go in. I went in with my book and I went into his office and there he was standing on his head. So I said, well, I'm ready if you are. He said, well, I'm ready. And I said, we don't look it. And anyway, that was usual with him. Mm. So we had a good relationship and his wife was there, a nice wife. I was known as a Molly the Wren because I was the only Wren in Neville section. There were other Wrens there. They were in Hut 6 or 8 or whatever it was. And I was put to stay in Bletchley in the local Coleman's and his wife's house, tiny little house, with an ATS girl. We not only shared a room, we shared a bed. Ooh. And she used to clean her shoes on my pillow and it was all together. Mm. It was pretty grim, pretty grim. Mm. And I stayed there until the Wrens began coming. Mm. And when they began coming, we went to Wattenden. And that's much better. It was a lovely place to be. I was very happy there in Hut 4. All my duties were admin. I was introduced to all the people around. Of course, they were very eager to see a Wren in Naval Section. And Commander Tandy became quite a friend of mine, Hugh Foss. It's funny, on the first day I went to the canteen and Hugh was sitting down, so I sat next to him, having been introduced to him. And he said, I don't want to talk to you. And I said, well, why? He said, because it's my lunch hour and I'm relaxing. And I said, well, what are you doing? He said, I'm doing a crossword in Japanese, Russian or something, Japanese, I think. Mm. And that was his idea of relaxation. They were all odd bods. And I was sitting in my office one day and in came a man and he looked at me. He stripped all his clothes off. This is when we went to Block B. Mm. Stripped his clothes off, jumped out of the window, jumped into the lake. Now, this wasn't extraordinary that other people did it. They went into a loony bin 3 months and then brought back again to break more codes because their brains were just borderline. Yes. But it was quite an eye-opener to a 19-year-old.
Yes. Yeah. Go back a little bit. When you joined the Wrens, obviously you didn't know you were going to go to Bletchley Park, but did you have an idea of what sort of job you were going to do, or was it?
Well, I was hoping something to do with sailing, something to do with boats in a port.
Yeah.
If they told me it was Bletchley Park, that meant nothing to me anyway, but if they told me it was Bletchley, I would have said, well, can't I go to the sea? And I don't know why I went there, whether it's eeny, meeny, miny, moe, or whether it's because I was a naval family. I don't know.
Yeah. And you were in Hut 4, I think you said, to start.
I was in Hut 4, and it was that very, very cold January, February. We all had our coats and gloves on. It was so cold that on my day off once a week, it was a Thursday, I always remember, and my hands were bleeding. They were so cold. And I used to go to my cousin up the line in Berkhamsted and have them bound up for that day. It was really cold. We used to wake up in the morning with our greatcoats over our beds and they were white with dew because the heating was almost nil.
Yeah.
There was a radiator near me when I was working for Hut 4. And the other women used to bring in their frilly smalls and put them on the radiator to dry.
Yes.
I mean, it's all very basic.
Nowhere else to do it.
No.
Were you sort of with seeing Frank Birch every day? Or,
yes.
Or, yes.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah. Every day, every afternoon.
Yeah. Yes. I know, as we've said before, you didn't know a great deal about what the work was about, of course. You knew what you had to do, but what impression do you get of what he was doing?
The overall picture.
Yeah.
There was a big room, reception room, and the head of that was called Miss Senyard. Must be long since dead. Yeah. And that's the only thing that I was trained up into. see all the cables that were coming in, a lot of them, because there were hundreds of thousands. And I had to see by call signs and so forth where it came from, who it was, and who it was to be directed to, Hinsley or whoever it was. So I was trained in that, and I got a picture then that when all the call signs, all the blocks became English, then they went into Frank, and then Frank would deal with it from there. I didn't know what he did with it.
No. But so these were presumably the signals that had been decoded at Bletchley Park. Would that be right? So they were from Enigma and things like that. Yes.
Oh, it was before Enigma.
Before right.
Wasn't broken then.
No. So other codes,
yes.
And were they German, Italian?
Yes, German. Yes, both German, Italian.
Yeah.
And it was later Japanese.
Yes, yes, of course. And can you remember what sort of things were in these signals?
No. They were mostly blocks of letters. They mostly hadn't been translated.
Oh, I see.
And I had to, they were just call signs. And I had to know who dealt with each block.
So you were looking really at the call sign rather than what
I was.
Yeah, right. Gosh, yes.
I used to see quite a few people coming in, spies like Fleming, who I had a great deal to do with later on. And they used to come in for a few days and then go off, be parachuted somewhere, and I never knew where. That was the worst thing about Bletchley. You know, knew part of the story, got interested, and then were told to shut up because you mustn't know too much.
No. But did you know that the place was to do with decoding and
emissions? Oh,
yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I only asked that because some people weren't even allowed to know that.
No, I did.
Oh, yes, yes. You mentioned Hugh Foss already, but did you know Harry Hinsley? I think you said you...
I knew Harry very well, and I'm just trying to think of the person he worked with who he married. And I cannot remember her name.
I can help you. That was Hilary Brett.
Hilary, that's right. Yes. They were working close together. Yeah. Harry, yes, I used to have lunch with him, and he was very nice, and he was always very nice to me. He was a very courteous man.
Yes. But he must have seemed, compared to the other people you knew, very young, I suppose.
Yes.
Noticeably young, because he was the same age as you, wasn't he?
Yes. We came, as I remember, from Cambridge or somewhere.
Yes,
but they all appeared fairly young, except the head was a brigadier there. What the heck was his name?
Would that be Tiltman, perhaps?
Tiltman.
Yes. You met him then, did you?
Oh, yes.
What was he like? I'm asking you some rather basic questions because
I only knew him
so long ago. Since
I only knew him for lunch or something like that. Yeah. And he was a very nice, courteous man.
Yeah.
I didn't work with any of these people.
And you mentioned the Ettinghausens.
Oh, yes. Now, the two Ettinghausens, I think they've changed their name now.
One of them, and I forget which one it was.
Came ambassador.
That's right, he went to Israel after the war, changed his name to Eitan, which I suppose was
Ernst. Ernest.
Walter and Ernest, I think it was.
It was Walter I knew mostly.
Yeah.
Mm. And what happened to the other one?
I don't know. I think they probably died some years ago before people like you were making contact with Bletchley Park and saying, because, you see, people like of that sort of age, really, I think they'd either passed on before they felt able to talk about Bletchley Park, or in one or two cases, they did live into the sort of the era when it ceased being secret, but for whatever reason, didn't want to talk about it.
But this even goes on now with me.
Oh, yeah.
Because when I heard Bletchley Park mentioned on the telly, I thought, somebody's going to get it in the neck, you know?
Yes.
And my parents, my friends, I said, nobody knew where I worked or what I was doing or anything. And you had it so put into you that with the official secrets and the enemy and so forth, that you just never talked. You just didn't.
Yeah.
And not only never talked to people outside, but you didn't talk to people inside. I, of course, went as a Wren. Then I became a petty officer. And then Frank wanted me to become an officer, so I went to Greenwich and went through the usual blah, blah. And then he had me back at Bletchley and he said he wanted me to be 1 month at Bletchley, 1 month in NID, in Admiralty, which I did.
And your work in NID, what was that? Was that the same sort of thing as at Bletchley?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
And I'm just trying to think who I was under. He wasn't an admiral, he became an admiral. Yeah. And I wanted to say Denning, but it wasn't. Maybe Denning, I don't know. after that 6 months, Frank said that Boddy, Mr. Bodsworth, that he was over in America. He was at the Naval Communications Annex in with the BP of America, and he wanted a helper and a secretary. And Frank wanted me to go over. So I went over, and I was over there for, I don't know, it must have been nearly a year, about 10, 11 months. The Japanese war was then still on. That was a wonderful time. I thoroughly enjoyed it. But I had to be under the auspices of the British Navy. This was by the head of the RENs over there. And she was riled because I wasn't under her jurisdiction. So she put me under the jurisdiction of the naval attaché, which, of course, was then Ian Fleming.
Yes.
So I was introduced to him. Yeah. I'd met him before in Bletchley, but I was such a little minion that he didn't recognise or remember me. And we got a good relationship going. And because he was naval attaché, he had an aeroplane given to him, a little one. And we used to go for weekends sometimes, wander around America. And then one day he rang me up and he said he wanted to see Jamaica. Would I get some leave? So I got leave and we went down. We danced, I remember, all our way for 2 days down the coast of Virginia and the Carolinas. London. He was a very severe, he could be very friendly, he could be extremely cruel. He could be charming. He's all sorts of people put into one. And when he saw Jamaica, of course, he fell in love with it and came back and lived there and died there.
Yes.
No, it was good about that.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.